Hello, and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at. No court-ordered daily check-ins for Border Patrol Chief Greg Bovino for now. We have the latest on that legal battle. Millions stand to lose food assistance as the program is set to run out of money this weekend amid the ongoing government shutdown. And cuts to local news are at a record high. What's behind the losses? First off tonight, a downstate sheriff's deputy is found guilty of second-degree murder in the shooting of 36-year-old Sonia Massey. A jury today convicted 31-year-old Sean Grayson of killing Massey in her own home after she called 911 for help in the summer of 2024. Grayson shot Massey as she was moving a pot of boiling water, which he had requested. He was originally charged with first-degree murder, but during deliberations, the jury was allowed to consider second-degree charges as well. Massey's family members reacted to today's verdict, calling it a serious miscarriage of justice.
I know that there'll be justice for Sean Grayson, and it might not be in this world, but it'll be in the next one. My joy here today is that I know I'll see my baby again.
Grayson was also charged with first-degree murder. With this second-degree murder conviction, he faces up to 20 years in prison or probation. Sentencing is scheduled for January 29th. Border Patrol Chief Greg Bovino is getting out of his court-ordered daily check-ins, at least for now. Just yesterday, a federal judge ordered Bovino to make the appearances at Chicago's federal courthouse to recap the day's enforcement activities as part of an ongoing lawsuit involving federal agents deploying tear gas on protesters and journalists. The Justice Department filed an emergency motion looking to toss out the judge's order requiring the daily meetings, claiming it significantly interferes with ensuring the nation's immigration laws are properly enforced. An appeals court granted an emergency stay hours before he was set to appear. Plaintiffs have until 5 p.m. on Thursday to appeal the stay. A Democratic candidate for Congress has been indicted, along with five other people, on charges surrounding a protest outside the Broadview ICE facility last month. The federal indictment says Kad Abu Ghazaleh, who's running to represent Illinois' 9th Congressional District, Catherine Cat Sharp, running for Cook County Board, and others forcibly impeded, intimidated, and interfered with a federal agent. In the video posted to social, the protesters are seen trying to physically prevent an SUV from entering the facility while chanting, some tapping or banging on the hood of the car. Abu Ghazaleh vowed to fight the charges, calling it a political prosecution. For more on what the other defendants and candidates have to say, please visit our website. Governor J.B. Pritzker says the current proposal to address the state's transit funding shortfall can't proceed in its current form.
Well, I have to say they sprung a whole bunch of things that have never been seen before. And so it's very hard to evaluate in a short period of time. I think there's a whole lot of work the legislature still needs to do. As you know, when you come up with a new idea, it's got to be run through the Department of Revenue to figure out how you might go about collecting the tax or what it would actually yield.
Illinois House Democrats this week pitched a so-called billionaire's tax on unrealized investment gains, raising the existing RTA sales tax and adding a 7% tax on statewide entertainment items like event tickets and streaming services, all to generate cash for CTA, Metra, and PACE. The Chicago area public transit system faces a more than $230 million estimated budget deficit next year and more in the following years. Backers of the bill say their plan would raise as much as $2 billion for public transit, with some $220 million going to downstate systems. Chicago officials are applauding a reported move by gunmaker Glock to phase out an existing line of firearms. It comes after the city filed a lawsuit against the company, alleging it knowingly manufactured guns that can be illegally converted into semi-automatic weapons using an item commonly known as a switch. According to the city, Glock will reportedly cease the manufacture and sale of its current models on November 30th. Spokespersons for the company did not immediately respond to requests for comment. Up next, the possibility of millions of SNAP recipients losing those food assistance benefits this weekend. We discuss right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
Nearly 2 million Illinois residents face losing their SNAP benefits, including close to 900,000 in Cook County. That's if Congress fails to pass a budget by November 1st. The federal government has been without a budget since October 1st, making this one of the longest government shutdowns ever. The U.S. Department of Agriculture says it will not use emergency funds to prop up the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program during the shutdown. Joining us to talk about this are Nolan Downey, Senior Director of Policy at the Greater Chicago Food Depository, Aubrey Lewandowski, a local SNAP recipient, and on Zoom, we have Professor Lindsay Allen, a health economist and policy researcher at Northwestern University's School of Medicine. Thanks to all of you for joining us. So we know that Illinois is among the 25 states that are suing the Trump administration over this freeze on SNAP, commonly known as food stamps. The USDA said in a memo that, quote, contingency funds are not legally available to cover regular benefits. SNAP contingency funds are only available to supplement regular monthly benefits when amounts have been appropriated for but are insufficient to cover benefits. The contingency fund is not available to support fiscal year 2026 regular benefits because the appropriation for regular benefits no longer exists. Nolan, SNAP benefits had been available during previous past government shutdowns. Why is this one any different?
We don't believe this one should be different. We agree with those 25 other states that the federal government has the resources, the experience, and the ability to fund SNAP even if the government shutdown persists. To be very clear, they have SNAP contingency funds that are there exactly for this purpose, and they have a number of other funds that they could deploy to make sure that people do not go hungry in November. At the Food Depository, we say that hunger is a policy choice, and right now, the federal government is making the choice to let people go hungry in November.
Lindsay Allen, when a program like SNAP is suspended, what's the economic impact both on families but also their communities?
It's larger than you might expect. So SNAP is not just, you know, a lifeline and part of the social safety net for Americans. It also is a huge economic driver in communities. So we're missing out on $8 billion for the month of November if Congress can't get this sorted out. That won't be going in to local communities.
Right. We just heard from the Illinois Retail Merchants Association yesterday, also sort of preparing their members for the confusion that might be coming forward if those debit cards are no longer working starting this weekend. Aubrey, you have been using SNAP benefits for about 2 years. Mm-hmm. What are you thinking? How are you getting ready for this potential loss?
Just trying to plan ahead as much as I can. I have four children. Between 4 and 13, just making sure that they have enough healthy, nutritious things to eat, planning out. I have friends that are working with me, too, and we're kind of meal prepping, planning each meal to know that we have enough to make ends meet if, indeed, the shutdown does continue and we don't get our funds in November.
Four kids, that's a big family.
Yes.
And you, two of them with special needs. Mm-hmm. So what is at stake for them? Because from what I understand, one of your sons has autism, level mm-hmm. three. And kids with autism can be picky about food. And it's not just picky. It is a real, real consideration for you as a mom.
Yeah, it is. Because while I do utilize the food pantries, like Nolan mentioned, to assist in additional things on top of the benefits, there's a lot of things that aren't always readily available at food pantries. A lot of more perishable things like eggs, milk, cheese, or having a child who does have sensory processing and food aversions. Like, I can only feed him certain things, and I rely on those benefits to make sure that he has everything he needs, as well as all my children. They're all active, growing kids.
Yeah, they got to eat, obviously.
Yeah.
So yesterday, Governor Pritzker addressed what the state can and can't do to support residents who depend on SNAP. Here's a little bit of that.
We're going to do a lot to support our food pantries and other organizations that are privately operated, but they're nonprofit organizations that support nutrition and food for people across the state. It's not as much as SNAP because we can't afford to do what the federal government can, but it is what we can do. And we are, in fact, working in Springfield right now to make sure that we're prepared.
So, Nolan, can the Greater Chicago Food Depository, can food pantries, the community, can you all meet the needs of this moment?
Unfortunately, we can't. And while we're so grateful for the additional support that the governor mentioned, we know that for every meal that we provide, SNAP provides 9. So this is not at the scale that we're able to meet. As the governor pointed out, we can't replace SNAP at the food depository. And while we're going to do everything we can to make sure that people in our service area, Cook County, who walk into pantries are able to leave with the food that they need, we know that at the end of the day, people are going to go hungry if they don't get their SNAP benefits.
Say more about that. What does that mean for families like Aubrey's and the 900,000 others in Cook County who could be losing benefits this weekend?
Oh, well, there's an immense amount at stake. You know, we're talking about 1.9 million people in the state, $350 million each month from SNAP that gets injected into our state economy. This is just simply not at the level that we at the food depository are able to meet. And I want to be clear. I mean, we're very proud of the work that we've been able to do during periods of heightened community need. We were there for people during COVID. We were there for new arrivals when they were coming into the city, and we will do everything we can to be there for people this weekend and beyond. But we can't replace SNAP.
Lindsay, critics of this kind of federal assistance say that, you know, government-funded social services discourage work. What do we know about the connection between SNAP and employment and economic mobility?
We know that the facts are that we actually see SNAP as an economic engine for people. So typically when we're trying to get people into the workforce, the best way to do it is to make sure that they are fed and healthy and can show up every day to do their jobs. Same with children. You can't have kids going to school every day hungry, or they're just not going to be as focused. They're not going to be able to focus on getting an education, which is a kid's job. So I think thinking of this as a way to prevent any sort of waste or fraud in the system is missing the point in a way that is going to cause real harm to these families.
Aubrey, what's your monthly benefit, and how does that help you and your family?
For myself and the four children, I receive about $1,150 a month in my benefit. That puts most of the food that we need on the table. Being able to get fresh produce, that's a big thing. I mean, kids, to stay healthy, they need nutritious food. Like Lindsay said, just being able that they can stay healthy, because if they aren't healthy and they miss school, then I miss work along with that. So I want them to be able to be healthy. Getting fruit, vegetables, well-balanced meals, everything. I don't know how we would make ends meet without the benefit.
And you said you've been using SNAP for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. What were the circumstances a couple of years ago that you found yourself needing it?
I lost my full-time job that I had. And then for a period of time, I was unemployed and then pretty much underemployed since. I've spent the last 2 years looking for higher, better employment, but nothing has materialized that's really going to work out for us, for our family. So I've had to become reliant on the SNAP benefits with my work schedule.
What kind of work are you able to find now to cobble together?
I do delivery driving for DoorDash, Uber Eats, Instacart, and just kind of pick my schedules, because then I can only work when my kids are in school. So it works out well for then, and then I don't have to make up that difference to cover childcare on top of everything.
Right. What do you want people to know about the people who depend on SNAP?
That this is a very real thing, that there are families that will go hungry, especially with the cold weather coming up. Nobody should be put in a position where they have to choose between paying a utility bill or buying food. Being fed is like the basic of most human necessities. Everybody needs to eat, and nobody should ever think that they don't have their next meal coming.
So beyond the shutdown, come December, there will be some changes to SNAP that were outlined in the Big Beautiful Bill Act. Notably, work requirements are expanding so that able-bodied recipients must work 80 hours a month with some exemptions. It limits the eligibility of non-citizens so that refugees, asylum seekers, they will lose benefits. Next year, some of the costs of benefits will be shifted onto the states. Nolan, what else do people need to understand about the impact of the shifting policy?
Well, I think the first thing that everyone should recognize is that we are dealing with a sequence of crises with this program. Not only is it bad enough that people could miss their benefits in November, but very shortly thereafter in December, people are going to have to start meeting these work requirements, as you mentioned. And that means 80 hours a month that people like Aubrey and other folks have to try to cobble together to maintain their benefits. But I think the most important thing for people to understand is the exemptions you mentioned. There are many people in the state that should be exempt from these requirements. And so it's incredibly important for folks to go and submit those exemptions and that information to the Department of Human Services. If they feel they need an exemption, they need to get that information to the state before December 1st so that hopefully they won't be impacted by this.
Lindsay, conservatives like the Illinois Policy Institute, they point to the state, they point to Illinois' SNAP error rate and say that that is one way the state could be saving a lot of money because our state's is among the highest at 11.6%. Could the error rate really make a difference for the state in saving money?
Not to the extent that we are going to see people harmed by not giving SNAP out in the next month. So the error rates include anything from a typo to misqualifying somebody. And so there's so many reasons that we could have someone erroneously be taken into the computers as a error that it's really overstating how many people are getting SNAP benefits when they normally shouldn't be.
Aubrey, the holiday season is coming up. Mm-hmm. What do you want lawmakers to know? What do you want them to do?
Definitely try to come to an agreement so that the government shutdown ends. But on top of that, like the funds that they're talking about, like hopefully release those. Make sure that these families, like mine, other families, will be able to have all the food, all the nutrition we need on a daily basis. Just nobody should have to worry whether or not they're going to eat, and that needs to hit home.
Nolan, we've got 30 seconds left. What policy options would you like to see put in place to prevent something like this from happening?
Well, first I'll say, just as far as the shutdown is concerned, we know that healthcare is at the center of this, but people cannot afford higher premiums just as they cannot afford to lose their SNAP. So I would leave the audience with this simple message that even if the government shutdown persists, the federal government has the ability to fund SNAP and make sure that people in the state have the food that they need.
Okay, that's where we'll have to leave it. Thanks to all of you for joining us. Aubrey, especially, thank you for sharing your story with us. Aubrey Lewandowski, Nolan Downey, and Lindsay Allen. Thanks, everyone. Up next, what's driving the crisis in local news coverage right after this? A nationwide shortage of local news coverage, and it hit record levels this year. 50 million people across the country have limited or no access to a local newspaper. Here in Illinois, 47 counties have either one local news source or none at all. That's according to a new report from the Medill Local News Initiative, which tracks media outlets nationwide. Joining us to talk more about the report is Tim Franklin, professor at Northwestern University School of Journalism and founder of the Medill Local News Initiative. Tim, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for having me here.
So you all found that in the last 20 years, 40% of all U.S. local newspapers have vanished, more than 130 papers shutting down in the last year alone. What's driving this?
Yeah, well, the business model for local news has collapsed. Advertising was the pillar that supported local news for many, many years, and that's basically imploded. Advertisers have moved to different platforms, to social media, and to other places. So they're now trying to desperately replace the revenue that's being lost But as you say, there are now 213 entire counties in the U.S. with no source of local news. 50 million Americans have no local news source. We're losing on average 2 newspapers a week in the U.S. So I don't need to tell you, we're living through this historic transformation in how news is consumed these days and how it's produced, how it's distributed and paid for. And so anytime an industry is going through massive disruption like this one, you're going to see destruction and you're going to see creation. And we're also seeing some creation, which is good. But right now, destruction is winning.
Yeah, and I want to come back to that creation for sure. Locally, though, this means that Illinois has lost more than 46% of its newspapers since 2005. What are the challenges that are hitting local media here in our area?
It really depends on what part of the state you're in. Southern Illinois, south of I-80, really struggling with local news. And in north of I-80, in the Chicago area, the Chicago region is actually an incubator of innovation, if you will, for local news in many ways. And we're seeing new startups being created in the Chicago area. The problem and what keeps me up at night is that in downstate Illinois, in many of these counties, there's just not the capital, there's not the investment, there's not the philanthropic support, investors to support local news in many parts of the state. So we have kind of these news haves and the news have-nots. And that's really a problem.
And what happens in that case, right? What happens by these losses and the information that folks in those areas aren't getting?
Yeah, we're studying that. But anecdotally, people go to Facebook groups, for example. And it's great that people are civically engaged on Facebook. The problem with that is there's no journalist in those Facebook groups doing what journalists do. Fact-checking, checking sources, checking documents, talking to sources, the things you do. And so there's a lot of misinformation, disinformation that ends up in these Facebook groups, and that's actually fueling this kind of tsunami, I think, of misinformation around the country. So that's a problem. And then we also see that in these low-information counties that civic participation goes down. Turnout in local elections, number of candidates seeking local office. And that's because people don't know what's happening with those elections. That's a problem. We also see there's evidence that government spending rises in these areas because the journalists are the watchdogs. They're the traffic cops, watching what's happening in these communities. So that's another issue that we're seeing.
So at the same time that all this is happening, as you mentioned, you are finding that digital-first media startups are booming. We, like you said, we've got quite a few here in the Chicago area. Shout out to Block Club Chicago and Borderless.
Right.
Tell us more about these and who they serve.
Yeah, so over the past 5 years, we've seen more than 300 local news startups created across the country, and about an average of about 60 a year. So these are, in many cases, entrepreneurs. You mentioned Block Club Chicago, which I think is one of the great success stories in America in journalism in the last 5 or 6 years, not started by billionaires, but by journalists, kind of out of the ashes of DNA Info. I mean, they've incrementally grown that organization over time. They're filling a huge need in the market for coverage of Chicago area neighborhoods. That's great. We're also seeing digital startups in Cicero, the Cicero Independiente, the Harvey World Herald down in the south suburbs, and even the Record of North Shore up on the north suburbs where a paper closed a few years ago. So these are smaller than legacy organizations in many cases, but they're getting their sea legs and they're serving a market and a need.
Are they able to make up for the gap in local reporting, and or could, some of these more rural, like you said, downstate communities, could what we see here be replicated to sort of fill the void in those areas?
I certainly hope so. I think the concern is that getting resources and finances to those areas is a real problem. Now there are things that could be done to address that. Illinois was the first state in the nation to adopt public policy and get public policy funds to local news organizations. So there's a tax credit so news organizations can retain and hire journalists. That just passed last year, and actually the funding just started in over the summer. So that's one way that policymakers are trying to, if you will, incentivize the hiring and retaining of journalists across the area. And hopefully, we'll see more public policy in other states.
Few seconds left. How should reporters, newsroom leaders, how should we all be adapting to these changes and this uncertainty in the industry?
You know, it's a time where you got to meet consumers where they are, and they're getting news in all kinds of different platforms, YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, and they're playing an increasingly important role in the local news ecosystem. So it's not just a matter of producing a story for a newspaper. You've got to produce it in different forms across different platforms.
Got to go to the audience.
Yes.
I think there's more research that's coming out as a part of this project. But I think you're going to have to come back and tell us about it.
I'd be happy to.
Next time.
Okay.
I think we're out of time. Tim Franklin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. And that is our show for this Wednesday night. You can stream Chicago Tonight on our WTTW YouTube channel every evening and catch up on any programs you may have missed. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a personal injury law firm that gives back to the community through law and philanthropy.